Case number 20-5216 et al. Edward Banks et al. Versus Quincy L. Booth in his official capacity as Director of the District of Columbia Department of Corrections and Leonard Johnson in his official capacity as Warden, D.C. Department Corrections, Appellants, United States. Mr. Schifferle for the appellants, Mr. Marcus for the appellees.
Mr. Schifferle, good morning.
Good morning.
Please proceed.
Thank you. Good morning, and may it please the court, Carl Schifferle for the defendants. I would like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal. The preliminary injunction should be vacated for several reasons. First, it automatically expired by operation of the Prison Litigation Reform Act, the only issue on appeal being whether the injunction was entered in, quote, any civil action with respect to prison conditions. It clearly was. Alternatively, plaintiffs failed to establish the four requirements for preliminary injunctive relief, particularly where they failed to show the deliberate indifference necessary for a constitutional violation and Monell liability, both of which would be required to succeed on the merits. Even if all four factors were satisfied, the preliminary injunction was not narrowly tailored, and the district court later erred in denying reconsideration, failing to apply the requisite flexible approach and to recognize that changed circumstances warranted vacater. As to the first reason, the PLRA applies here. It follows directly from how the plaintiffs presented their claims below and the district court decided them at the preliminary injunction stage.
As you know, in the Southern District of New York, the court concluded that it did not apply where we're dealing with the COVID conditions. What's your response there?
So there are several responses. I would start with how the plaintiffs did characterize their claims, that their claims regarding the conditions of confinement, the conditions related to COVID, were claims brought under Section 1983, that their claims for release were claims under habeas. The district court granted the preliminary injunctive relief under Section 1983, conditions of confinement, but not as to the habeas claims for release. So we have that distinction. We also have the fact of the applying that to the express language of the PLRA. It does apply with respect to prison conditions and further defines that phrase as any civil proceeding arising under federal law with respect to conditions of confinement.
And as you know, and just help me here, appellees say they have, in this case, raised habeas proceedings challenging the fact of confinement.
Well, as I said, the relief was granted on the Section 1983 conditions of confinement, not with respect to release. In any event, it wouldn't matter because the PLRA would still apply. This case is about conditions of confinement. It would exist but for conditions of confinement. It also follows from this court's precedent in Blair Bay and In re Smith, where the court recognized that conditions of confinement claims are, quote, precisely the type of claims that the PLRA sought to address. In those two cases, this court applied the PLRA, first of all, to mixed claims. That's where a conditions of confinement or a traditional civil claim was joined with a habeas or other type claim. Those mixed claims, the PLRA applies, this court held. This court also applied the PLRA even to just habeas claims, where those habeas claims are based on conditions of confinement. Again, that's
so let me ask you then, what finding did the district court fail to make, in your view, such that her injunction would not extend beyond 90 days?
So it's not even contested that the district court failed to make the requisite findings under the PLRA. There's no argument from the plaintiffs on appeal that it was made. That what was not made was the need, narrowness, intrusiveness findings. The district court did not mention the PLRA or these requisite findings. It did not make the findings, the need, narrowness, intrusiveness findings. It didn't even-
Was any of this brought to her attention by the parties?
The district in opposing the preliminary injunction did alert the district court that under the PLRA, that these findings were necessary, that the court would have to make these findings. The court was unable to or unwilling to make those findings. And so as a result, certainly the district court was on notice of this deficiency.
Thank you.
And the other requirement of the PLRA in order for the automatic expiration provision not to kick in was that the order be made final within 90 days. Again, no dispute that that requirement was not satisfied in this case either. And so as a result, the preliminary injunction did expire by operation of the PLRA after 90 days. This is not disputed by the plaintiffs at all on appeal. All that is disputed is whether the PLRA applies in the first place. And I think we've established based on, how the claims were presented below, the express terms of the PLRA, this court's precedent, which recognized not only the purpose of the PLRA in addressing conditions of confinement claims, but making sure that plaintiffs could not evade the requirements of the PLRA simply by dressing up their claims in a certain garb or joining a habeas claim or a claim for release
Let me back you up to two things. First, on the New York decision, are you conceding that that decision was correct? I mean, you distinguished the case, but do you need to? It's not controlling. So.
That's correct, Your Honor. It's not controlling. It's easily distinguishable.
Never mind distinguishable. You're not conceding it was rightly decided, are you? Or are you?
We are not conceding that.
Okay.
No. And the second thing,
as far as the suit addressing the fact of confinement, does it really address the fact of confinement when the whole basis for attacking confinement is the conditions of confinement? They didn't say you can't lawfully hold me. They said you can't lawfully hold us under these conditions. Is that not correct?
That's absolutely correct, right. Your Honor. This is the heartland of the PLRA. It's a conditions of confinement claim. This case would not be here but for conditions of confinement. In the complaint, the plaintiffs alleged a whole set of conditions that they sought to be improved. The only one aspect of that was downsizing. It was not even downsizing such that it would result necessarily in the plaintiff's own release. That was not necessary in order to ameliorate the plaintiff's injury. So it's not what was alleged below. It's not plaintiff's contention below. And even if it were, again, even if this were a no set of conditions case, the PLRA would still apply by its own express terms and conditions because this is an action with respect to conditions of confinement. And the PLRA recognizes as well that even in conditions of confinement cases to which it applies, release may sometimes be necessary relief. That's why it has a specific provision in paragraph A3 addressing prisoner release orders. So there's nothing that takes this case out of what the PLRA was intended to address, conditions of confinement. And this is exactly that type of case where the district court has entered a fairly broad injunction governing, large aspects of jail administration. This is what the PLRA was intended to address. If there are no further questions on the PLRA, I would like to address the merits quickly in my remaining time. There was no intentional or reckless disregard of the risks of COVID by Department of Corrections officials. To the contrary, the undisputed evidence was that the department immediately undertook extensive and broad measures, robust measures designed to address those risks based on the guidance of CDC, DC Health, and other experts. This included entry screening, suspending in-person visitation, educating inmates and staff on preventive measures, also testing, isolating, quarantining inmates based on the public health guidance, including quarantining all new admissions for 14 days. There was a medical stay in place order that was properly implemented, limiting inmates to 1 hour out of cell time per day. There was a significant reduction in the jail population through the actions of the district and other criminal justice partners, decreased it by 16% within 3 weeks, by 27% within about the first 2 months. There's no dispute as well that the Department of Corrections undertook other policies and procedures with respect to social distancing and enhanced sanitation. And although the district court found fault with the implementation or enforcement of those particular policies, there was no dispute that the content of those policies were appropriate and also that efforts had been made to implement and enforce them, even if those efforts were ultimately imperfect. And that is not a basis for constitutional liability, as this court has repeatedly held in cases like Franklin and Scott. At most, what is at issue is the failure of subordinates to implement policies, but that cannot suffice for constitutional liability. I do want to save some time for rebuttal, and I see that I am running low. If there are any further questions from the court, I'm happy to take them.
All right, Mr. Shifley, we'll give you a couple minutes in reply. Mr. Marcus.
Good morning, and thank you, Your Honor. The district court's injunction was and is critically necessary to protect the health and safety of 1,500 Department of Corrections residents and hundreds of DOC staff whose union
Does that address the motion for dismissal?
Yes, Your Honor.
Isn't the motion well taken, the 90-day rule motion?
For two reasons, Your Honor. The first is the text of the Prison Litigation Reform Act.
Tell me what part of that text doesn't apply here.
The PLRA only applies to civil actions with respect to prison conditions, but expressly
exactly. And isn't this a civil action with respect to prison conditions?
No, Your Honor.
At
its core, this is a habeas petition challenging the fact of confinement. There is no doubt that in this circuit.
Now, wait a minute. The fact of confinement or the conditions of confinement? As I read your complaint, you're attacking the conditions. You're saying you can't hold me under these conditions. You're not saying you can't hold me. Is that not correct?
Our complaint does address the very fact of confinement, Your Honor.
It says can't hold us. It says you can't hold us at all.
It says that during the coronavirus pandemic, a disease that spread in congregate facilities like nursing homes, cruise ships, prisons, and jails, that COVID transmits rapidly in those settings. And so our petition did seek release for everyone, for all of the named, for the named plaintiffs and for all of the proposed class members in the action on the basis that the mere fact of being held in a closed, cramped facility.
Being held in a closed cramped. If they had not been held in a closed cramp, would you have had a case at all?
If the court had...
In home confinement or solitary confinement with hospital conditions, would you have had it? You don't allege anything about the fact of being held. You had alleged something about being held under these conditions, don't you?
Your Honor, I do understand that this is a bit of a gray area, but
this
we
is
did
a
allege
stretch. This is more did, of a gray area.
We did allege that the mere fact of being held in a prison facility, which by its very nature is a closed, cramped, congregate facility.
Okay.
The facts alleged
okay,
in this case.
Okay. You're not going to get anywhere. So I'll leave you alone.
Well, I'll just direct the panel to the Sixth Circuit's analysis in Cameron versus Bouchard, which is directly on point here. In that case, the plaintiffs and petitioners brought a joint 1983 and habeas petition challenging the fact of confinement. And they alleged both that the conditions in that facility led to the claimed injuries and that release was the key remedy that the district court should grant. Now, the district court declined to grant release. It only issued an injunction that addressed the conditions of confinement. But nevertheless, the Sixth Circuit concluded that the core of that challenge was a habeas petition to the fact of confinement, even though the petitioners also challenged the conditions of confinement. Now, the application of that case in this district is even stronger, because in the DC Circuit, unlike the Sixth Circuit, petitioners can challenge the conditions of confinement in a habeas petition. That was this court's square holding in Ammer versus Obama in 2014. All of the claims that the plaintiffs and petitioners brought here could be brought under habeas. Challenges to conditions of confinement are appropriate. And where the core of a challenge is to the fact of confinement, and where the core remedy being sought is release, the PLRA doesn't apply. And for this circuit to understand that the core was release, we direct you to the complaint and petition itself.
Well, that's what I've been looking at, and I want to know where I can find what you're telling me.
Your Honor.
Yes.
A couple of places in the complaint and petition. Paragraph 7, our plaintiffs claim that downsizing is the only way to minimize harm done by COVID-19. paragraphs 33 to 47, discussing generally the cramped conditions of prisons. And then paragraphs 133 to 138, which discuss specifically why downsizing is the only remedy that can provide relief to plaintiffs and petitioners.
I understand that, but I don't see the request for release of everybody.
That was the first form of relief requested, Your Honor, was writs of habeas corpus for as many members of the proposed class as would be necessary to safely allow for social distancing in the facilities. Precisely the same form of relief.
So you were recognizing there that others could be held under the conditions that would then prevail.
That's correct.
In other words, this is precisely about conditions of confinement, not the fact of confinement, because you do acknowledge in that part of your complaint even that the fact of confinement can continue. It's just the conditions of confinement that you're attacking.
That's in your prayer for relief.
Yeah.
That's correct. The central argument was that release of a significant number of residents of DOC would be necessary for social distancing would be necessary to cure the constitutional problems in DOC. Exactly the same kinds of claims Your Honor mentioned in the Southern District of New York in Fernandez-Rodriguez, and exactly the same kinds of claims that were brought in Cameron versus Bouchard. And I want to explain why this makes sense. Not just the text of the PLRA, which expressly excludes challenges to the fact of confinement here, but the purpose as well, is that when a petitioner challenges the fact of confinement, when a petitioner says release is the central remedy, that implicates the most serious liberty interest. And it would make sense for Congress not to erect the most significant gatekeeping to those kinds of remedies.
Would we have expected, had Congress been thinking as you're saying, would we not have expected that this 90-day provision would have said that it does not apply in cases where the conditions are the basis of the habeas type claim?
Well, Congress did say it applies to challenges to conditions. So
that's what it says.
Right.
And so that's what it says. And if they intended to exclude cases where those conditional claims include a recitation that you can let part of them go and keep part of them, wouldn't Congress have had some provision excluding those from the 90-day requirement?
I think that provision does exist in this exception excluding challenges to the fact of confinement, where release for hundreds of people is the central remedy that Congress has already erected.
The order here that we're having the motion about did not involve release at all, did it?
That's correct.
It was addressing simply the conditions of confinement, wasn't it?
That's correct. But
this then constitute a civil action with respect to conditions of confinement?
I don't think so, Your Honor. And I think that looking at the relief that the court ordered is not what the text of the PLRA requires. The text of the PLRA requires looking at the proceeding, a civil action challenging or a habeas corpus proceeding challenging. And we think that's the analysis that should apply here.
You think you can take this out of the PLRA by joining your conditions claim with a plea for release?
Yes, where the core of the challenge is.
Wouldn't Congress have recognized that?
I think that Congress did recognize that by creating different regimes.
They just didn't write it down.
Congress did create a regime for review of habeas proceedings, and there's significant gatekeeping hurdles to bring a habeas proceeding. The district court has to order a response in the first instance, so the district court regularly reviews petitions that might be frivolous. There might be exhaustion. In fact, there are exhaustion requirements for habeas proceedings. So it's not as if there aren't barriers set up for
it would have been very easy if Congress intended to let habeas joinder take out the conditions claim for Congress simply to make a cross reference.
Well,
that would have been a very simple thing if Congress meant to do what you're saying, that Congress meant to say you can put in some language about habeas and take the case of the civil action over conditions out of the PLRA. And that's what you're saying that Congress did, but we can't find the Congress did it anywhere.
We think that by including that phrase, excluding habeas petitions challenging the fact of confinement, Congress did recognize that
actions. You ever heard Justice Scalia's remarks about mouse holes?
Yes, sir.
Okay, you think Congress hit an elephant that size and a mouse hole this small in this?
Well, we dispute that it's an elephant. As the Southern District referred to, these cases that address the fact of confinement are quite rare. And they have arisen during COVID because the very nature of the injury there, it does stem directly from the fact of confinement, being confined in cramped, crowded facilities. I did want to mention briefly why remand would be appropriate here and just direct the court's attention to Hudson versus Hardy. In that case, this circuit was confronted with a question of whether an action sounded in habeas or sounded in civil action. There, the district court did not have a chance to address the nature of the proceeding in the first instance. Here, the district court has not had a chance to address the application of the PLRA. And so we think that remand to the district court to ask these very probing questions would be helpful. And this court would have the benefit of a fulsome opinion to review on appeal, as is the normal course.
But counsel for appellants cited, he cited where the PLRA was brought to the district court's attention.
So, Your Honor, I think that's not correct. I don't think that appellants raised this issue before the district court. Appellants, while their motion for reconsideration was pending before the district court, where appellants would have had every opportunity to alert the district court, we think the injunction has expired. And appellants didn't do so. They filed a suggestion of mootness in this circuit. And even when appellees said this issue would be best presented to the district court in the first instance, appellants nevertheless declined to present this issue to the district court. And so this court does not have the benefit of a district court opinion on this complex issue.
Your understanding is that this was only raised by the district in a motion for reconsideration?
No, the district declined to raise this in its motion for reconsideration. They raised this, the application of the PLRA in the first instance before the circuit.
Well, I just want to be clear, and I'll ask Mr. Shifley about this. I understood him to say that the district had opposed the entry of a preliminary injunction by referencing the findings that were required.
The district court did oppose the preliminary injunction, but did not raise this issue, the application of the PLRA.
However, if they're correct, then this is a jurisdictional question, isn't it, since we're talking about mootness? And jurisdictional questions can be raised at any time, right?
Definitely, Your Honor.
And the court's obligated, even if they're not raised, we're obligated to pass on jurisdictional questions, are we not?
That's correct. That was the exact situation in Hudson versus Hardy as well, Your Honor. Same question of mootness, the same question of how a petition should be characterized. And nevertheless, in that case, the circuit did remand to the district court to decide in the first instance.
There are no more questions. Mr. Shifley, I know that Judge Rogers at least has a question for you.
Yes, Mr. Shifley, you heard me in talking, saying I may have misunderstood what you said as to when the district raised the application of the PLRA while in the district court.
So in the district court, actually beginning even before the opposition to the motion for preliminary injunction, the district did raise the applicability of the PLRA. I did mention specifically in opposition to the preliminary injunction, and this is at page 39 of the defendant's opposition. The defendant specifically cited section 3626 and the requirement of need, narrowness, intrusiveness findings that they would have to be made in order to justify the preliminary injunction. And again, the district court did not or was unable to make those findings. Further, there was no dispute that the PLRA actually applied to the plaintiff's Section 1983 claims. The district also raised an argument under the PLRA of failure to exhaust, and the plaintiffs did not suggest that the PLRA did not apply to their Section 1983 claims. They argued that exhaustion had occurred, and likewise, the district court never even suggested the PLRA didn't apply here. It went ahead and decided exhaustion on the merits. And so it was clearly sort of raised and preserved, and the district court was clearly alerted below to this issue. I wanted to address, to continue my opponent's arguments, that first of all, this was not a case where release was sought for everybody. There was no claim that the jail had to be emptied. There was no claim that the plaintiffs themselves needed to be released. There was simply a claim that the population should be downsized to some extent, but that was also simply to ameliorate a condition of confinement, that is to enable social distancing. So again, this is a conditions of confinement case. Also that the plaintiff's argument, while this could have been brought in habeas, is a moot point because the plaintiffs chose not to bring their conditions of confinement claims under habeas. They chose to bring it under Section 1983. They made clear to the district court that that was the basis of their claims, and that's specifically at the April 22nd transcript at page 20, which we did cite to in our brief. That's where that that characterization was specifically made to the district court. I think Judge Sentau, you are correct that there is a concern here that if the PLRA can simply be evaded, if a plaintiff can simply tag on a claim for release under habeas to any conditions of confinement claim and simply say, well, I need to be released because of these conditions, then the PLRA could be easily circumvented in any case just by adding that on. And that's something that obviously should not be permitted. It's something this court did not permit in Ray Smith. And that should be followed here. I would finally just note the Supreme Court's decision in Porter versus Nussel, again, applying a very broad reading to a conditions of confinement claim. It applied it to a claim of excessive force, a single incident, applying it broadly. And again, in Porter versus Nussel, the Supreme Court recognized the importance of not allowing the PLRA to be evaded simply by clever pleading.
All right, if there are no more questions, then counsel, thank you. Your case is submitted, and Madam Clerk, if you would call the next case.